took a bottle with you that morning. We blessed it with holy water, you see, and probably a couple of big cupfuls in the bottle. You just sprinkled, you know. You just sprinkled it on top of the stones and made the sign of the cross. You were burning, what they used to say, you were burning the bones of the earth. That was the old saying. It was a bloke that came up from Abbeyfield that I heard claim that all the old lime burners of old used to say it.
The process of burning limestone to produce quicklime is believed to have been developed over 2,000 years ago. Pliny the Elder, who lived in the 1st century AD, wrote about the production and the uses of it at that time. However, it is believed the process was known for at least two centuries previous to that. It traditionally had three popular uses. It was used in building as an ingredient in mortar and in plaster, and also in limewash. It was also used in tanning, for cleaning the skin and for removing the hair, and in agriculture as a fertilizer to sweeten the land and also to neutralize acid in the soil. Burnt lime, or quicklime, also had a more sinister use, as illustrated in this poem. In Reading Jail by Reading Town, there is a pit of shame, and in it lies a wretched man eaten by teeth of flame. In a burning, winding sheet he lies, and his grave has got no name. And in this powerful verse, and all the while the burning lime eats flesh and bone away, it eats the brittle bone by night and the soft flesh by day. It eats the flesh and bone by turns, but it eats the heart away. That, of course, was Wilde's poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail, written while he was in Reading Jail, describing an execution he saw in the prison. Quicklime also made at least one, dramatic entry into Irish politics when a fist of quicklime was thrown at Parnell. This is how his wife, Catherine, described it. It was during one of these last meetings that someone in the crowd threw lime in the chief's face. It has been said the thing was a hoax and the substance thrown was flour. It was not flour, but lime. And had not Parnell shut his eyes in time, he would undoubtedly have been blinded. However, in this programme, we are dealing with the practical and less dramatic uses of burnt lime. The lime was produced in kilns, always pronounced kills, with the N silent. These were stone structures, shaped like a spinning top. The stone, limestone from the quarry, was fed in at the top, known as the mouth, and the finished product, the lumps of burnt lime, came out at the bottom, known as the eye. Wood charcoal, turf, column, a type of anthracite, and coke cinders were used at different times to burn the lumps of blue stone. When subjected to the full heat of the fire, the blue stone was transformed into white or greyish-white lumps. These were lumps of lime, also known as quicklime or burnt lime. In this programme, we examine the life and work of a lime burner as seen through the eyes of two men, both lime burners. One is Marty McAuliffe of Lixna, County Kerry. The other will be known in this programme as the lime burner of Church Hill, an imaginary village somewhere between Mallow and Charleville in County Cork. The account here is based on an unpublished memoir. The reader is Thomas Dudley.
I got a job in Churchill Quarry, and the job was following a pony but drawing the stones from the quarry up to the kiln. I now had something I never had as a farm worker, and that was I now had half day and the wages were better. I had 25 bob a week. I was only there 12 months when I was shifted into Mallow to the two lime kilns in the Nuns Walk. Just before I was shifted into Mallow, I used to have to work 3 days a week in Churchill, and I used to have to go to the other 3 days to Ballymac, clearing away the top of the quarry, clearing away the soil. Then I was going into Mallow from 1936 up to 1941. There was no quarrying in there, but there was a fellow with a hired lorry carting the stones from Churchill Quarry into the kilns in Mallow, and the stones were all piled up. I was inside in Mallow one morning in the kiln. I used to have to be in there at 8 o'clock, and I wasn't too long inside at all when this man came in, and I only knew him by eyesight. I knew that he was a mason. He came in anyway, and he asked me, could he take a measurement of the eye of the kill? Of course, it was equal to me. I said he could, of course. Anyway, I asked him. I knew that he was going to build a kill somewhere, but I asked him anyway, and he said he was. I'm building a kill, said he, in Churchill, for a man by the name of O'Brien. We got about a week after, Murphy came in home one night, and I up and told him about this Bill from Ireland. That was his nickname. He was a native of Donnerail, and he was a great mason, coming and measuring the eye of the kill and building a kill in Churchill for a man by the name of O'Brien. Here it is, Tadeen, says Murphy. Now is your time. Look here. Go down a Sunday to Patcheen and Jimeen. They live down Chalival side. I didn't know where Chalival was. Says I have no business going down there till he have it built anyway. Well, says he, the sooner you go there, the better. And in the meantime, says he, the Lord of mercy on him, I always think of him for it. In the meantime, I'll have a talk with Jimeen O'Connor. He was a farmer that lived up Mount North near Ballymac, and O'Brien had all his land taken for tillage and grazing. And there was two or three of his daughters that were in charge of O'Brien's shops down the country. So I begot it passed off anyway, and about 2 or 3 months later, who come into the kill again but Bill from Ireland. I asked him how he was getting on the kill, and he says, I have it built. I said, have he it started yet? No, said he. He's only opening the quarry, but he told me, he said that he, a very decent man, that he'd be opening it after Christmas. Oh, by God, I was getting uneasy then. I thought in my own mind that I should go down and see about it. When I went home that night, who came in but Murphy? I up and told Murphy that the kill was built. You're a bad luck to you. He was a very rough, vulgar sort of man. He said, you're losing a good job. Do you think, he said, that you could carry it on? Do you think that you could manage it? I think, I said, I'd have no bother about managing it. Do you know, he said, how much column you'd burn in a day or a week? And, you know, he started asking me questions like that. So I gave him an explanation of it, and he said he'd go up to Jimeen O'Connor tomorrow night if he'd take it on. One Sunday, I went to Ballymac Mass, second Mass, and when I came home, Mam says to me, there's a Mr. O'Brien, says she, after coming, calling here, looking for you, about the lime kill. And he stopped about a quarter of an hour. He said he couldn't wait, but he'd call again at 2 o'clock. He's to call to take you down to have a look at it. So we got good enough, he came in the car and with Mulcahy. O'Brien was questioning me all the time from Churchill about the tonnage of stone and about the amount of column it would burn and all that kind of stuff. And I was able to tell him, and he seemed to be quite satisfied about it. He told me from the start that he wasn't worried if he never sold lime, that he wanted it for himself. For he had 2 farms in Ballymullen. He had all this land up the mountain, and of course it was on the mountain all this lime was wanted.
What did it do for the land?
Well, it was supposed to be very good anyway. Even lot of that land now around Abbey Field and Mount Cullen, that place was only mountainy land that time, and they used to put out, they used to mix the lime with the sand from Ballybunnan out of the sand at about 4 to 1. One lorry of lime and 4 lorries of sand. And they used to put that out as tops and to turn the grass blue. So they used to claim anyway, the farmers.
O'Brien, who had given the job to the Churchill lime burner, was a successful businessman and farmer. He also provided him with accommodation in an old farmhouse near the Killen. The lime burner and his family had half the house.
Anyway, he brought me down and showed me the kill, took me down and painted a lovely picture about the lovely house that I'd be living in, and who it was belonged to one time. Right, came down and looked at the house, and he said, I have oats, he said, inside it at the moment. We were caught short for storage, but he said, I'll have it cleared out and put in a lovely range there for you. That house hadn't been occupied for half a century or over it. The Toomeys left it about 1911, just before the First World War. They left it and went down to Churchill House, and I was the first to occupy it after them. He had divided the house, and he had another fellow who was in charge of the cattle living in the back portion of it. As far as I understand, that house had been built for the Tomies, and they were all reared there. They were all reared there, and we found at the back of the shutters in one of the rooms upstairs, they had the dates down where they were confirmed. They had marked. 'Twas back in about 1906 or 1907. Anyway, when we came out of the car, and when he, O'Brien, was taking me into the kitchen, he said, well, now, he said, I'll give you, he said, good wages to start off with. I'll give you, I don't want you to be working in the lime kiln all year. You'll work during the winter months in the kiln, burn the lime, and during the summer months, I'll want you on the farm. You can do farm work. I'll give you £2.10 a week on the farm, but you'll have overtime. And he said, when you'll be burning the lime, I'll give you £1 a week extra. That was an awful jump, you know, from 30 bob a week. I was delighted about it. I was only there 3 or 4 months when O'Brien came over one Sunday and told me that there was a black Angus heifer on the land that was in calf, and that she was to be calving in such and such a length of time. And he said, you can have the use of her for the milk for the children. Yes, 'twas marvellous. 'Twas a great jump, great leap in the world. 'Twas an awful jump for me now, you know, from £1 10 a week and paying rent and no perquisites. So anyway, a fortnight after that, that was the week before Christmas. Then Christmas came, and he had it ready for January, and 'twas Jackie Lucy that brought us down a Saturday evening down to Fern House. The day before I lit it, I had to collect a lorry of waste timber. Well, that wasn't any bother. It was only a case of filling up the lorries with all this waste timber inside the carpenter's shed, and at the time they were only glad to get rid of it. Any of the blokes that was working with me didn't know, hadn't the faintest idea how it was going to start. But what puzzled them altogether, when I started filling the kiln with stone and the column without any fire in it, they were whispering between themselves, where the hell is he going to light it? Or how is he going to light it with the stones? Oh, the secret was, you see, that when you go to light a kiln, you must have the timber up to the first cylinder, or have the cone full of timber at least. But you can half fill the kiln if you like. It's up to yourself. But if the timber is dry and you know you're going to have a good fire, the cone will do you. And have the driest timber you can in the cone. And then you must have the timber as level as you can. And then the next thing you have to do, you have to cover the timber with stone, the raw stone, in one stone in height. One stone, not another stone on top of it. Only one layer of stone, and it must be as level as possible. And how you know it's level? The same ring of brick must be appearing all around. When you have that done, then you must put a light layer of column over that. The tops of the stones would still be sticking up through the column, and then you count 3 rings of brick up, and then you put in your next layer of stone 3 bricks in depth, and then column again, heavier coat. You'd have the stones just covered then with column, and around by the side, around by the brick, and half an inch out from it, you'd have it about an extra 2 inches of column around by the brick, but not against the brick. The idea of that is that brings the fire up the side quicker. It was very slow and difficult when you start off, and when you're down 23 brick works out that you have 6 layers of stone, 6 threes are 18, and 5 brick will work out then the height of the column, you see. Well, we have 1 layer in. What are you going to do now, Tim? Are you going to light it? No. Anyway, we had the kiln full about 4:15 or 4:00, having started after dinner. When Jimmy and Mulcahy was there, and Bill from Ireland, the man that built the kiln, was there, he was supposed, of course, having built the kiln, he was supposed to know how it was filled. Well, he gave me that impression anyway, himself and Moriarty. Anyway, I suggested to one of the men that he bring some of the stone from the heap that was broken outside to bring it in to help the lot that was broken inside, so as not to wait until all the stuff was inside and gone into the kill. So the next thing was that I see Bill from Ireland going over to Jimmy Bryan, who was barrowing over the stones, and he telling him that he should handle the stones into the barrow and not to bring in any of the brass or the small grit that was in between them. And Bryan, when he brought over the barrow of stones, Mulcahy said to him, "Why don't you use a shovel, Jim?" Mulcahy used to talk very fast, you know. And says, "That devil, he says, told me I wasn't to bring any of the brass that would choke the kill." So I said nothing, but I just felt like going over and telling him to mind his own business, but I didn't know where I stood. He was there by instructions from Ryan, you see. Anyway, they were watching me all the time to know what I was doing. And I came down when I had it full, and I pressed the tire in sort of edgeways under the eye, and I put in a fist of dry timber and threw a pint of tar on it and put a match to it. And whoosh, in the course of about 10 minutes, boom, all the timber catching fire inside it. But what was puzzling them all together, there was no smoke coming out. You know, they thought that immediately it was lit underneath, that smoke would be up there, but there was no smoke came up. That was the laughable part of it, you see. With the dry timber, there was no smoke. It was all ablaze. But it was when the tire got rightly going, it was then it started to smoke. There was no smoke coming out of it until about 10 to 6, and it was only just barely coming up around the sides then until about 7 o'clock, and it was raining then by the same token. There was a good volume of smoke about it. Old Julia Dore, the Lord of Mercy, she was passing home from Churchill with herself and Joe and the donkey and car. And when she went down to the lower bridge, her husband and Mick Canty, the Lord of Mercy, they were at the bridge talking, and she said that the lime killer had the kill on fire. I always think of old Mick Canty, who told me. And she never called me anything after that, only the lime killer.
Could you describe the process like? When you cut the stone, what did you do with it then? When you brought it to the kiln, what happened?
You started your kiln with turf. You put about 2 hearts of the turf in the bottom of the kiln. And you put a very light layer of anthracite for a start and a very small layer of stone. And you continued on then layer after stone, anthracite and stone, until your kiln was full. And you set fire to it in the bottom, and you'd leave it resting for 3 or 4 days until the fire came up. And you added on then layer after layer of anthracite and stone again. And you might maybe for the first week after starting, you mightn't get anything out of it. But after that, then you'll be drawing it, and you might draw out a barrel of lime with 5 cubic feet. You might get 20 barrels a day out of each kiln, which would be going right. And you had no more, there was no more setting fire to underneath. You kept adding to the top and taking out underneath, and that was the process from then on.
It would take the fire usually about 3 days to make its way up. It would be 3 days before you could take anything out of it, for the simple reason that along with the lime being burned, it'll take a certain length of time to cool, and also, according as the timber was burned away, the kiln dropped about 4 to 5 brick down. And when that happened, that is when the fire came to the top, you filled the kiln again with another layer of stones and a layer of column on that end. You had your kiln full then. It meant you had the kiln full from the cone up.
Your trousers and until I see your legs, please. Yes. Yes, it's yes. You've had plastic surgery on your legs.
I had in both legs, from the ankles to the knees, yeah.
Could you explain how that happened?
Well, it was Christmas Eve morning, about 10 o'clock. I was, we were finishing out the kill for Christmas. We were leaving it out, like you see. And I put in 3 or 4 barrels of anthracite on top to spread it around to burn out the top of the kill. And the kill was stuck in the centre. There was a cavity in the centre, and when I was spreading the anthracite, the kill went down and the flames came up. And only for the help of the shovel, I'd be burning inside it. Well, with the help of the shovel, I got out of it, but I was...
You were on top of the kiln?
I was, yeah.
Did the you were standing on the lime?
On the stone, yeah.
On the stone, on yeah. The limestone, and yeah. It collapsed under you?
It collapsed for about 4 feet. There was 4 feet of a cavity in the centre of the kiln. And I didn't know that.
And you fell down into the fire?
I went down with the stone under me, and the flames went up about, I don't know, that went up for a split second, you see. And I was burned. There was no skin left in both legs, from the ankle to the knee. I had to get plastic surgery in that much, like.
Did it go past your knees?
It did, went up to around there, but not...
You weren't badly burned?
Not third degree burning, is it?
From the knees up?
No, just from the knees to the...
These were first-degree burns on your feet.
Oh yes, from where the plastic surgery. There was no skin at all left there, like, from the knees to the ankles.
And what happened after that?
I was in the Bonsecours Hospital in Tralee for a week, and I couldn't do anything for me, of course. Only the bandages that were done after I got in, that were left on. And the doctor in Tralee, Dr. Horgan. He's dead now, Lord, the mercy name here. He helped in a great way to get me flown to England. Also a sister of mine that was married in England. And there was a man from... He used to run Western Airways in Leixlip. Captain something, I can't think of his name now, but it was I had the plane from him for £100, and I was flown to Gatwick. And I was taken to the Queen Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead, and I got the plastic surgery done there. I was there about 4 months. I came home and I'm all right.
You have had no ill effects?
No, except a touch of old varicose veins, that's all.
Farmers do when they took the burned limestone home from the kiln?
Well, they used to draw sand from Ballybunnan, from the shore, and they'd cover the heap of lime with the sand, and they'd leave it in, and the lime would be slackening and swelling under the sand, and they'd turn that and make what they call tapters out of it, and they used to take that out in the horse and car and spread it with shovels in the fields. And they used to put it in tillage, put it out of ground, and it was supposed to be very good for the land anyway.
How about whitewashing?
Oh, sure. There'd be donkeys, cars and horses, cars, and for barrels of lime and half barrels of lime for whitewashing houses, because nearly every house in Kerry at that time was a whitewashed house. And where there'd be new house built, even, that wouldn't be whitewashed, the old house would be, there'd be an outhouse made of it, and it would be still kept whitewashed and well whitewashed. And the pillars of the gates would be whitewashed, and the walls would be whitewashed, and there was to be a terrible sale for lime for whitewashing, more especially before Christmas time, you see. That was the time you would have the most of the sale for the whitewashing lime, and also in the springtime.
Now, this burnt lime could be dangerous. People were known to lose their eyes as a result of say, whitewashing with it.
And
it was burning hot.
It would burn, and if it, if it, and it was known to burn hay sheds and farmers. It would leave the kill and go on the horse and car quite cold, but if they put it near hay or near the hay shed, when that would be slackening, it would come to fire again, and it was known to burn hay sheds.
This would be internal combustion, I suppose.
I suppose it would be, yeah.
The hay and the heat of the lime.
It was known in Arkery to burn at least two hay sheds in farmers. I can't think of their names now, but I remember it.
Over the years, the Churchill man learned something about quarrying. He learned how to use explosives.
You use your own judgment about the amount of gelignite needed. You take whatever length of fuse you need and stick one end of it into the detonator, and then you have to squeeze it closed on the fuse. I remember often doing it with my teeth. Then you press the detonator into the top of the last stick of gelignite into the hole. On top of that, then you pour in fine, dry soil or sand as packing. You see, that has to be packed in with a rammer. The rammer was made of timber. The idea was to make the packing as tight as possible. Nothing for it then, only light the fuse and you go as quick as you could.
The farmers were the principal buyers of lime. They used it as a fertiliser, and there was a subsidy following it. There was a special technique for applying burnt lime to tillage land. The lime burner explains.
A farmer usually had the lime taken by lorry to his farm. Well, if the weather was wet then, and the land was mucky, he had to take it into the farmyard and store it, or else leave it by the roadside and throw it off on the green along the road. That's if he couldn't store it in the yard or the lorry couldn't get it. If he could get into the farm, he'd dump the lime in one spot with his own horse and butt. He'd then take it out on the tillage field. If he was putting it where he'd be having wheat or barley or oats, he'd make little heaps, about half a barrel in each little heap, and he'd judge when that was slacked off. He'd just estimate how much of a space of ground that would cover. Sometimes he'd take away the topsoil from where he was going to make the heap, and by taking away the topsoil it was moist, and the soil that he'd be after removing, he'd put that on top of the heap. So in a couple of days, if he didn't get rain, the whole thing was slacked off. He'd come along and spread it then with a shovel, scatter it around. He'd have so many acres, say 6 acres of barley or whatever it would be, and there'd be so many barrels of lime to the acre. There'd be 6 or 8 barrels to the acre.
Where did you sell most of the lime? Where did it go to?
Most of the lime went to North Korea and West Limerick.
Why was that?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it, you see, you had lime kilns in the other side of Tralee, Ballymacallaghan side, and they supplied that side of the county more or less, you know, like, and all our lime went towards Abbeyfield, Dewar, Newtown Sands, Tarverton, Mount Collins, Tournefulla, all those places, like.
The Churchill man had an eye for profits and advised his employer on the subsidies.
The first year O'Brien opened the kiln, he was only in touch with the Cork County Council as regards a subsidy, but then I suggested that he get in touch with the Limerick Council for the simple reason why they were giving a bigger subsidy for the farmer. The farmer in County Cork was only getting 1 and 6 a barrel. The farmer in County Limerick was getting 2 and 6 a barrel. And O'Brien was the lowest priced lime producer in either Cork or Limerick. So when he began to advertise and the lime began to advertise itself, it was then it started to open up. Now the best customer, one of the best, he was the best, and that was Lord Muskerry, that lived in Drumcollagher. And he must have had 500 or 600 acres of land, and he took so many ton of lime every year until he had the whole lot limed. And every time he came for to give an order for the lime, all I had to do was, when I had the lime ready, was to send him a card and let him know when to come for it. But it was always a pound tip. He was about, I think he told me at that time, he was about 75, and it would be 2 years after he came around again looking for lime, and we weren't burning at all. And when I shook hands with him, his hand was the same as if you caught a cold stone. And he died about 3 months after. The first year that he took lime from me, he took 18 ton of it, and they put it all in a heap in the middle of some field. Anyway, it was after raining for a day and a night, and of course all the outside of it was slacked off. But the cows, anyway, the following day, the cows were running from the flies, and one cow, didn't she, run into the middle of it and couldn't get out of it, and all her udder got burned. At the time, she was valued for a good price, about £50. She died from the effect of the heat. Couldn't get out of it, you know. They came with lorries, and they came with tractors and trailers, and they came with horse and butt, and they came even with donkeys and carts. And the way they took it in the donkey's cart, they took it in bags, a barrel in each bag. The only fellow on a bicycle would be Tommy Murphy from Churchill. He'd want a stone or half a stone of it for whitewashing. For whitewashing, sixpence worth, a shilling's worth. I cut out the sixpences, and then I wouldn't accept anything less than a shilling, because they'd expect as much for sixpence as they would for a shilling. The meanest man I ever met was a man, Jackie Mulcahy's father, the Lord of Mercy. He used to come every year for 2 barrels of lime. And what the 2 barrels of lime was for whitewashing all the stalls and the outside houses when the cattle were out. And if there was any stones left over out of the barrel from any lime that was badly burned, he'd bring back them stones the following year. Occasionally there'd be a lump in it, you know, that wouldn't be fully burned. And of course, when any lime that was in it would melt out, the stone would remain in the centre, and he used to bring back. There would sometimes be half a dozen or a dozen about the size of a cup or smaller, but he'd always bring them back in the old tin barrel, old tar barrels we used to call them. He'd bring them stones back when he'd arrive in with the old donkey and cart. The first thing he'd do when he'd paid for it and he had his receipt, he'd turn the old barrel sideways, and he'd throw out the heap of stones, and he'd say, "I want an extra shovel for them." The only other complaint I had was from a fellow by the name of Cullity, and he was from Fina, and he was always complaining about if he found any stones in it. I got vexed with him one time, and he said he was after taking 2 lorries of lime, that was 12 ton of lime. He had 3 farms and a subsidy for each farm. Well, I said, "I don't think," I said, "that there is yet a lime born or ever born that out of 12 or 15 tons of lime that he wouldn't find a stone." So I was right there, of course.
As a man who's experienced in this, would you regard it as hard work?
Oh, God, there isn't any doubt about that. It was very hard work. After the drying out of the lime underneath the kiln was the dirtiest part of it. It was there, we got the dust, and if we were long enough with that, the blood would come from inside of our nostrils, you know. But against that, and again, it didn't ever kill anyone, because there was very old men that worked it all their lives, and they lived to be very old and healthy men. And after giving a date, you could go to the pub and you would drink 3 or 4 pints and relish them. And when you would come home and go to bed that night, your nerves wouldn't trouble you. You would sleep sound. It was hard work.
From my own experience, I'd actually say it was the hardest job a man could do. The heaviest work, because you were shoveling stone all the time, and lime. I burned 6 ton of lime in a day, so I shoveled 6 tons. I shoveled 12 tons, because every ton of lime I shoveled out from the eye I shoveled most of it back into the lorries again. You shoveled it twice. You shoveled it out and you shoveled it into the trucks and you shoveled stone and column in above into the mouth of the kiln. You were working off your arms all the time. It was a thirsty job, especially coming in summertime. It was. You had to persevere because the more liquid you drank, the more you perspired. So that you shouldn't give way to it. It was always said he'd drink as much as a lime burner. That meant that all those old lime burners in times gone by, they used to drink a lot. There was also a saying in times gone by that he was dry, as dry as a lime burner. The lime burner, of course, he was always in dust and heat.
The lime burner's work was hard, but there were small compensations.
I remember one time Jack Moriarty of Newtown came with a lorry for a load of lime. He used to play at full back for Newtown on their hurling team. And of course he had the job of pucking out the ball in the game. So I noticed him watching me out of the corner of his eye as we were shoveling into the lorry. So he says to me that this should be great exercise for the arms, great for a fellow like himself who'd play hurling. And you know, he's a strong man himself, but he couldn't believe how a small little man like me could pitch the line without any bother from the eye of the kill right out to the front of the lorry.
The lime burner's employer, O'Brien, died in 1947, and the farms were bought by Mrs. Morne, an Englishwoman with bloodstock interests. The change of ownership was to have repercussions for all the employees.
Must have been in October or November of the year Patrick O'Brien died that old Mrs. Morne bought the farms at Anna and took over the kill. She paid £15,000 for the three farms. She came up to me in the kill herself and Jim O'Brien, and he introduced me to her and told her that I was in charge of the kill and all that. And everything was all smooth and lovely and, oh yes, you can carry on and all this kind of stuff, but she never questioned me at all about the terms. She went away back to England then. She started objecting that I wasn't entitled to all that simply because I was an industrial worker, that I couldn't be indulging in all these concessions that I had off the farm and that I was putting expenses on the farm. The milk of a cow and a quarter of ground and all the vegetables I needed.
The dispossession of the old lime burner was symbolic of the times, because the end of the lime kilns was at hand. Coluch Sucre Éireann, the Irish sugar company, was set up in the 1930s, and two products were essential for the success of the new industry: beet to make the sugar and lime to till the soil. To service their needs, the old kiln system was much too slow. So to ensure a continuous and steady supply of lime, the company opened quarries and set about processing, delivering and spreading the lime. They introduced the new technology of stone crushing, and ground limestone, the stone crushed into a greyish-white powder, replaced the traditional quicklime. In the late 40s, the final blow to the kilns was struck, when the subsidy for burned lime was withdrawn. The fires were now extinguished, and the old lime burners turned their backs on the traditional and ancient way of producing lime.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.